listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and each week I will bring you guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. And I will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, leadership, and many great ways to keep your family mentally, physically, and spiritually sound. Now, having over 30 years experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields who are working to make this world a better place for all of us. And I'll continue to bring you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family. And we're going to be talking about leadership. But we're going to do it in a very unique way, and we're going to talk about an American who's probably had more influence on shaping the American character than anyone out there. Now, to help us talk about this character, our guest today is Tom Fitzgerald. Tom is the author of 6 books, including the novel Poor Richard's Lament, A Most Timely Tale. Now, before undertaking formal studies in physics, mathematics, law, industrial management, and English, Tom led what he calls a Huckleberry Finn childhood on the St. Lawrence River. And at some point, if we have time today, I'd love for him to tell us a little bit more about that. Now, Tom has served as a door-to-door salesman. He did that with home study courses. He was a vocational counselor for adults and children with developmental disabilities. He's been a stockbroker. He was the assistant to the president of a large healthcare corporation. He's been a lobbyist, a technical writer, and worked in corporate management. So we have somebody that really, I think, is very well-rounded in the American life and the American culture. So to talk with us about his book, Poor Richard's Lament, and the main character in that book, who is Ben Franklin. Tom, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, and as we were discussing a little bit off the air, I have enjoyed so much reading this book, and one of the reasons why is because at so many levels I felt that it made me think. You know, that there's so many things out there that we set out to do something, and our goal or our intent may be very, very good, and you make us think that there are times in which something that we think, you know, where we had great intent, the consequences of that maybe, you know, a few years down the road, maybe 100 years down the road, may be considerably different. And so that, to me, has made me really want to continue to read the book. In fact, it became one of those books that it was difficult to put down. So, Tom, thank you for that. And anyway, while we're talking about it, just tell us a little bit about, you know, Poor Richard's Lament.
Okay. Poor Richard's Lament, and the subtitle is A Most Timely Tale. It's roughly divided into 2 halves. In the first half, Ben Franklin has been cooling his jets in purgatory for 225 years since he died in 1790. And he's supposed to have been contemplating his errata, his mistakes, but instead he's added 12 more volumes to his autobiography. So he gets hauled in front of a celestial court, and there he's examined by 3 old arch enemies, including John Adams, who was just insanely jealous of Franklin. So the 3 of them forced Ben Franklin to confront all those things that he was supposed to have been confronting himself. And among these things are his legacy as a parent and a spouse, which was not exactly exemplary, and his participation in the commerce and convenience of the slave trade. One thing that pops out is Ben Franklin used to run ads for the sale of slaves in his famous Pennsylvania Gazette, and there was one ad in particular that always just haunts me since I discovered it. It's a woman with two children, a toddler and one a little older, and the ad is for the sale of the woman and the two children either together or separately. So who knows what happened to those kids, but the chance was at least there that they would be separated. And that all comes out in the first part of the novel.
Right, yeah. What I was going to say, and that was one of the things that hit me right away as well. And then, you know, for those of us that know a little bit about history, to know that he was one of the people that championed, you know, the abolishment of slavery. And, you know, it was never brought out, at least, you know, at the level of what I was learning history, was just what you just said, was the fact that on the one hand, that you can be saying that, you know, we need to abolish slavery. And on the other hand, you're taking money for ads for your newspaper to sell slaves.
Yes. Yeah, and that's there are several redemption threads throughout the novel, and this is one of them. The cover of the novel shows Ben Franklin's portrait. It's the portrait that's on the $100 bill.
Uh-huh.
And it shows a tear running down his cheek, and that's the lament part. And one of the things he laments is this whole participation in slavery. The worst of it was what I just articulated, that, you know, that he owned slaves, he sold slaves. But then over the course of his life, he came completely around. So one thing that was very attractive about Ben Franklin is his redeemability. He could learn from his mistakes, and he was willing to change anything that didn't hold up under the examination of logic. And for instance, he participated in the Constitution, the drafting of the Constitution, and one of the key parts of that was the Three-Fifths Compromise, where anyone was a slave was only 60% human. Well, he voted for that for expediency's sake, because the Constitution wouldn't have passed but for his participation, but for that compromise and his participation in it. But from that point on, he changed his view, and he came around so that in the last year of his life, he was elected by the Quakers as the titular head of the Pennsylvania Abolition Society. He had come full circle, but it took him 84 years to get there, but he got there.
Right. No, that was, again, some of the other things that was interesting to me was that at the same time, I felt like I was reading history, but I was getting a deeper view of history, but at the same time, you know, really looking at someone that was, you know, it makes you look at it and say, you know what, we're all flawed, you know,
yes.
And what can we do to grow from that? In other words, you know, do we stick to our guns and just continue to project a flawed ideology, or, you know, are we capable to be able to say, you know what, I made a bad decision, or I was given some bad advice, and I moved in the wrong direction, and I accept that, and I'm now going to fight to fix it. So, yeah, that was, again, part of the, you know, the enjoyment of reading it, is seeing this, and I think it would tell anybody that's reading it, you know, we're all flawed. Even someone that's looked at as one of the fathers of our country, and did an amazing amount of wonderful things for this country, you know, had some ups and downs in their life as well.
Yes, yes, and then that's what makes Ben Franklin a rich character, I think, in the book, is the other half of him. Once I didn't know about this other half, because they don't really put it in our history books.
Right.
So once I became aware of this, then his character really took off, because he became a whole human being. But as I said once before, that part of that is his redeemability. He was fully human, therefore he was capable of change.
Mm-hmm.
But he was changing from things that were negative and making them positives.
Absolutely. Now, did you, when you were thinking about this, were you considering other characters? I mean, did you research, you know, a variety of characters within our history, and just felt that this was the most interesting or the most human?
He just popped out at me. I didn't consider anybody else. Once I got the notion, it was many years ago, it was back in 1993 that I got the original concept of this. I was rereading his autobiography in the backyard one afternoon, and the muse just whispered in my ear, "What if Ben Franklin came back?" And he just seems like the perfect character for it, and I couldn't think of anybody else that would qualify. It's his approachability as a human being, just what we've been talking about. He was one of us. We all sense that, I think, on some level, that he's this approach of all the founding fathers, of all the people in our pantheon of heroes. He seems to be the most human. The most, we don't put him on a marble pedestal. We put Jefferson there. We put Washington there, and the rest of them. We don't. We put Ben Franklin in the pub with us, having a beer. That's where, you know, he's that kind of character. He has that approachability. And his multifacetedness. He was this polymath. He was an inventor, a statesman, a writer, a scientist, philosopher, humorist. It just goes on and on and on. He had all these facets to him that made him a gem. And then he had this wonderful sense of humor. He couldn't help himself. I mean, he was born with a funny gene. He just, everything he wrote was always had a little of the devil in it. It was just, everything that appeared in his 25 almanacs was sugar-coated with humor. He just had a just wonderful sense of humor. And again, and the other part that I learned as I went along is just his redeemability, just what we've been talking about. He just popped out as the perfect character for what I wanted to do.
Well, in contrast now, because again, for the people that don't know a lot about the founding fathers, in contrast, tell us a little bit about Adams so that we can see the contrast of Franklin versus Adams.
Yes, Adams. Adams was the natural foil for Ben Franklin. Adams was ambitious. He was vain. He was also brilliant, and he was a brilliant orator. All the things that, in those regards, that Franklin wasn't. Franklin was a terrible orator, but he wasn't vain in any measure. He loved working behind the scenes. He didn't seek the spotlight. And when Franklin went to France to represent the breakaway colonies to the crown of the French crown, to try to get them to come on the our side of the colonies, Ben Franklin was a perfect person for that. He established a rapport with the king's representative, and over a period of time, he kept getting more and more support from the French. Well, Adams goes over there to replace one of the other commissioners. I think there were three or four or five of them. Adams goes over there to replace one of these. He sees Ben Franklin staying up at all hours, schmoozing with the French, and started to spread rumors back in the States that Ben Franklin was the wrong choice. He was ill suited for the role. He was leading a dissipated life. And this is where Franklin gets his reputation as being a womanizer. He gets it from Adams, who's trying to malign Franklin's reputation enough so that he can get the attention that Franklin was getting over there and that he felt he deserved. And in many ways, Adams did get slighted a bit, you know, overshadowed by Franklin, and he did perform a critical role in the Revolution with his oratory. He's the one. He was the firebrand. He's the one that got everybody exercised and ready to revolt. So that they were just natural foils, and there was always this tension between them. And in the first part of the book, there's just a lot of repartee between Adams and Franklin because of this history. And as the repartees occur, you get more and more. The reader gets more and more of the history. The context around it, which makes the repartee, of course, all the more valuable and rich.
Yeah, now to share with everybody a little bit, again, having now read the book, is that, you know, when you have this celestial court, and you're writing in the same speech pattern of the way that they spoke in the 1700s, which started out a little difficult for me. I had to start, but once I got into it, you know, then it felt comfortable, and it really helps bring you in to this time period. You know, that the more that you get into it and stuff, the more that you kind of feel like, okay, this is interesting, which kind of goes into the history lesson part of it. I think it would be one thing to tell you how they may have clashed with each other, but to hear them do it in their kind of politely nasty way, you know, where you can say something very, very politely, but the underlying current is actually very, very negative and very mean-spirited. So that to me was one of the things that kind of brought me in. And I felt, again, from a history standpoint, not only am I learning a lot more about Franklin, but I felt I was learning a lot more about Adams as well. Yes. And again, things the history books never told us.
Yes. Yeah, that's an interesting point. I didn't anticipate that I would have to replicate the diction of the times, and of Franklin in particular, and Adams in particular. But once I realized it, I said, oh, my God, you know, I've got to do this consistently throughout the whole novel, because it's either it's dialogue or it's point of view. And either way, you've got to have the same vernacular that you're using. This was a tremendous commitment, and it took me, of the 9 years it took to write the novel, I'd say at least half of that was spent just getting the language right. And I did that by going into Franklin's original papers. There were 38 volumes had been accumulated at Yale University, and fortunately, 2 years after I began the project, they digitized all those volumes of writing, so I could go online and just access whatever I wanted of those papers. And it's just spent hours and hours and hours just absorbing not only the language itself, but its nuance and its culture. It has a culture to it, and it was I think even more difficult than learning a foreign language because of all this dimensionality to it.
Uh-huh.
It was a challenge, and it really stretched me.
Well, you know, I can tell that there was a lot of work in it, And I'm going to shift a little bit over to leadership. Why don't we see more Ben Franklins today? And what I'm thinking when I say that is that more people that are that quiet leader, the person that sits behind and looks at the big picture and says, okay, I really am a public servant, and as a public servant, my job is to make things better for the masses rather than and using Adams as the example, the sort of peacock leader of look at me, look at me, look at me, and needing to feed their own ego. And it seems like we have a lot more of the peacock leaders and very, very few of the quiet public servants that are just out there to help.
Yeah, I think I've thought about this a lot, and I think one of the reasons is we've built in filters that filter these people out. The scale has changed. You know, the scale in Franklin's time was modest and compared to what the scale is now. There are just a lot more people around, and it was difficult for quiet leaders to be discovered because they're quiet. They don't strut. They don't show us their peacock feathers. We've created a culture where, in order to get noticed, you have to be a peacock. You have to have feathers and you have to strut. Just because there's so much competition for attention now, that becomes a factor on visibility. I think that's a factor. I think also we don't in times past, there was sort of a contract that the wealthy had with the people who, the common man. And that contract was that people of wealth would give back by through public service. And you'll get people like Robert Moses, who created the St. Lawrence Seaway and the interstate highway system. Though he was a bit of a peacock, but he was part of this elite that comes from Harvard and Yale and Dartmouth and these elite schools. You don't see that anymore. That's just kind of died up, and I don't know if it's because the Brahmins have changed or what the factors are there. But we don't incubate leaders in our elite schools anymore the way we used to. So the media focuses. They tend to focus not on the quiet people but on the loud people. And so we all get inured of this, and we don't, just like robins in spring, we don't really see them anymore. This is just the way the things are done. And so we expect peacocks for our leaders and dogmatists and egoists, and we don't see the possibility of the others.
Yeah,
I asked people. I said, "When we get talking about this?" I said, "Now you're bitching and moaning here about the condition of our political system, but how many offices have you run for? You know, how much do you participate? These are the quiet people, and the quiet people want to remain quiet. They don't feel energized enough to participate in the system. And I really can't blame them because it's." The system has become dependent. In order to get visibility, you have to have money to buy the initial visibility until you reach a critical mass, and then you become the object of the media.
Right, and I think also that because I've actually had people bring up that exact point, and I think part of it is that the people that want to quietly work, you want to focus on that, and you don't want to spend your time. Fighting off, false accusations and things like that. I think that a lot of the politicians now have, I was going to say done a good job, but I mean done a good job in a very bad way to really make it very difficult for anybody that just wants to do good. If you go in there and you just want to do good, they'll come up with a way to demonize you. For doing that, and
yes.
it's sad that going in and projecting, I want to project hard work, I want to project success, I want to project positive values, and you want to project all of these things, and we've somehow gotten to a point to where that needs to be demonized, which is really sad. And I think the same traits for the person that wants to do that also wants to be able to take care of their family. They want to be able to take care of their local community. And they go, do I really want to drag all of them through this with me to try to go out there and make a difference on a bigger, on a bigger platform?
Yes. Yeah.
So which is sad. But, I mean, just because it's hard doesn't mean that we shouldn't do it, and that we don't really need to turn some of this around.
Yes. In fact, the Founding Fathers did not envision the creation of a political class that we call politicians, especially in the lower houses of the various legislatures, state, federal, county. They envisioned citizen legislators just like they were citizen soldiers. The militia was consisted of citizen soldiers, and the legislature was supposed to consist of citizen legislatures. But it didn't take long for that to go by the wayside. And people are people. The Buddha tells us that desire is the root of all evil. Well, people desire things like power, visibility, and they crave it, and then they start compromising away their principles in order to attain those things. And the whole concept of citizen legislator is goes by the wayside. I mean, one thing we might be able to try, at least on a local level, is what we have in our jury system. We have juries that are conscripted. You will serve.
Mm-hmm.
And we could do the same thing. I mean, we did it for the military. We could possibly do the same thing for our legislatures, is you will serve. You'll get a notice in the mail, and then you have to show up for your 2 years of duty. We did it with, you know, the draft in the military. You had to go in for 2 years, and that was service to your country. We don't seem to now look at the same as the political part as a common responsibility, but we might. That might be something to try. I don't know. Term limits comes up, but we don't seem to be making much progress in that area either.
Well, because they just jump from position to position and and still manage to hang in there for a long time. So is that one of the things that Ben would change about America if he could? If he was here today, what do you think that Ben would change, or would he just be so freaked out about the whole thing he wouldn't know what to do?
He would change. I mean, he would probably attempt to change several things, and using your approach of entertainment and inspiration and education. I mean, that's defining Ben Franklin, those three words. He would have a website that he would try to use to air ideas like this, not to so much promulgate his own ideas, but to have discussions like this. Because discussions like this are what can lead to real action. He was a genius at coming up with ideas, planting those ideas in somebody else, so they thought that they came up with the idea. Because he knew that if he promulgated his own ideas, people would look at him with suspicion as another egoist and just pay no attention. So he had this magic way of doing subtly promulgating ideas through the back channel, and that's, I think, it would be his main approach in having any kind of influence on the modern world is exactly that: come up with ideas and plant them in other gardens, other people's gardens. But as I say, education, entertainment, he would use his sense of humor to the max. Humor is so disarming. I mean, one of the things we don't get from our Senate and from our congressmen is humor. They seem so humorless. Ben Franklin would be appalled at that. He said, you got to have a sense of humor. One of the things you have to do is you have to be able to laugh at yourself. And you start there, and then work outward from there. So that would, to me, your approach would be his approach.
Well, thank you for the compliment. I think right now our own politicians, they're too busy casting aspersions on others. You know, they're so focused on how can we make somebody else look bad that, you know, that there's not a whole lot of humor in that. You know, and that's one of the things. And again, getting back to the book, and even with really saying some really mean spirited things, you know, in this celestial court, they're still doing it with a nod and a bow, and you know, and there's still a level of respect that's being provided, even in the eyes of. You know, of really saying mean things. So, and we don't seem to have that either. There isn't the, I'm going to respect where you're at and what your opinion is on this, but shouldn't it be this, you know?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I agree. So much is dependent on language and how the language is used. And the language can be a forked tongue. It can lash out, but at the same time have some gentleness to it so that the lash isn't as severe. And that's part of the language part of the novel. I had to be able to construct that to reflect just exactly what you said in the language itself. And that gives the language extra power.
Yep.
And that kind of sophistication in language you just don't see anymore. It's just not there.
Well, in as politely as I can, we're going to take a break. So now we are talking with Tom Fitzgerald. The book is Poor Richard's Lament. You're listening to us here on Answers for the Family. We will be right back in about 1 minute.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back, and you're listening to Answers for the Family. We're talking with Tom Fitzgerald. The book is Poor Richard's Lament, A Most Timely Tale. And let me tell you, it is a most timely tale. And you know, if you guys want to learn a little bit more about this, and again, you can do it while we're talking. You can open up another screen on your computer, obviously not if you're driving, but you can go to www.poorrichardslament.com. That's P-O-O-R RICHARDSLAMENT.com. And you can go to the website. You can see a little bit about what we're talking about here. We're looking at, and we were just talking a little bit about, I mean, you know, what would Ben Franklin do, or what would Ben Franklin change if he were here now? How would he go about it? And we were talking about, you know, he would use humor. He would have a website. He would want to entertain. He would want to educate, and he would want to inspire. So, you know, and those are things that we can do as well. You know, there's, you know, a lot of complaining. Well, look how negative the media is, and look how negative this is, or the, you know, the way in which politicians are doing things. We need to have people that are going to get involved and that are going to make a difference. In fact, Tom, I got to tell you, one of the things that I'm very proud of is my 16-year-old son came to me during the election, or you know, during all of the campaigning and everything, and he asked if I would get in touch with a particular politician that I know. Because he said, you know, Dad, he says, it looks like, he goes, I think I want to work maybe as an intern or something for this, you know, a local congressman. He said, because it looks like, he said, it looks like somebody in my generation needs to get involved, and they need to go in and approach this, you know, more from the standpoint of what is going to help everybody rather than indebting everybody, and it seems like they're not really caring about anybody other than themselves. Well, this is coming from a 16-year-old, and I got to tell you, when I was 16, I wasn't thinking about that at all. In fact, I wasn't really thinking about much more than probably girls and cars. So
in that the, order?
Yeah, maybe not. I don't know. But it's refreshing, you know, that I think that we have some very, very bright young people that are starting to recognize this, that aren't just kind of buying into all the rhetoric, and they're looking beyond everything, and it's happening, I think, all over the world. So so is much as we may get frustrated with some of the deception and things that are being done in the political arena, you know, there is, to me, a light at the end of the tunnel, in the sense that I think that we are bringing up a very intelligent generation that I'm hoping is going to see the mistakes that have been made and rectify them rather than compound them.
Okay, here's an idea for your son and for other 16-year-olds. I'm working with a college locally, trying to get them interested in this idea. So let me just throw it out.
Please do.
For consideration for your audience. It seems like we need to reach young people at just about the age of your son. Once they get into college, then it starts to get away from us. So this idea involves establishing a special program on campuses throughout the country. And this program caters to high school juniors and seniors. And it brings them on campus for a long weekend. And over this long weekend, they get exposed to this quiet leadership that's embodied by Ben Franklin, Martin Luther King, Aung San Suu Kyi, Nelson Mandela, Mahatma Gandhi. This sacrificial, reluctant leadership, contemplative, compassionate. And so we nurture, we expose them to this kind of leadership being legitimate, that this is a legitimate form of leadership. We know that you're not driven, your personality doesn't drive your, maybe you're introverted, you're not driven in this direction. But here's an alternative to the kind of leadership you see every day in the media. So this is what it looks like. Now, how might you use this kind of leadership in your life, throughout your life, in a family, as a member of a neighborhood, a community, state, in your country? What's in it for the colleges is that they get these juniors and seniors on their campus so they can have a look at their campus, you know, while they're there for this program. And what the kids mm-hmm. get is exposure to this kind of leadership and some incentive to activate it in their own lives. That's the kind of idea that I got from Ben Franklin. I mean, that's the way he thought. It just the step outside the box. How can we serve the larger community with something different?
First of all, I love it. I think it makes great sense. And with that, I mean, if there can be a way that it can be done, and I think you're right. It needs to be, if you take a group of many different leaders that have led in the same way, like the ones that you've mentioned. And have it sort of start out being the study of them, and then from that, how yes. you can take that and grow with it. I think that would be great.
Yes.
And one of the things that I would ask that a lot of the colleges, you know, if you set something like that up, allow these young people to come in and focus on that, and stay away from your own agenda. I mean, one of the things that's frustrating yeah. is that you have many now college professors that are out there that they think that their job is to continue to promote their personal agenda. You know,
yeah.
if they have a personal position on something, that they think that that's their job, and that isn't their job. We're their
yeah.
parents. That's our job to go ahead and discuss with them the things that we think are
yeah.
important. These are this is the moral ground that we believe in and the ethical values that we believe in. And I don't believe that the government or the, you know, in this case, the professors or whatever, that it's your job to try to change that. Now,
yeah.
now as parents, we're flawed also. So there are things that we shouldn't be promoting. Okay. But if you go into this from the standpoint of teaching your children that we are going to you know, we're going to give you wings, we're going to get you grounded, we're going to set it up to where you know the basics and stuff, and then we want you to go out in the world and make your own decisions. Don't be taken in so much by commercialism. Don't be taken in so much by what the media wants you to believe in. So yeah, I mean, I would love it, and if You say you're talking to some of the colleges. If there's anything that I can do to help, just let me know, because I think that you're right on target.
Yes. And you raise an interesting point. It's a chicken and the egg point. Who's going to teach these kids? And if it's a cadre of people that have their own agenda, then nothing is going to happen. It's just going to be the same old. You almost have to have a cadre of quiet leaders teaching a cadre of leaders. So how do you get to the point, to the start line, that you have this cadre of leaders teach the next generation? And that's very difficult. And the other problem I run into is even so modest a program costs money, and campuses now they're charging all they can in tuition, though they don't actually seem to have reached any kind of limit in that regard. But the first thing that I see on the faces of the college presidents that I get to talk to is, you know, concern, financial concern. You know, the fiscal cliff is on their shoulder, and their own local fiscal cliff, it seems like, all the time. So they think immediately in terms of funding.
Right.
And I don't have a workaround for that. You know, I could go out and try to solicit corporations, but then corporations don't do anything for free. So, you know, how do you keep an arm's length? You have them fund these programs, but then keep them at an arm's length. These are questions that I haven't got answers for yet.
Well, I think you've got the right idea, because, for instance, I've got a very dear friend that started a charter school, and he started it at a time and in an area where people said that it wouldn't work. And all that did was motivate him even more. And this is just an incredible human being that has dedicated his life to helping others, to especially helping the next generation. And he really fought, you know, he fought City Hall, so to speak, to be able to make this work. And he continues that fight. But one of the things that he did is he went out and he got Apple to provide computers for the school to be used with these at-risk youth. He's working with a particular group of kids that are not going to have, more than likely, a computer at home. And I was so impressed. I mean, he went out, he got Apple to do this. So I think I think you've got the right idea. If you can get to corporations, It's a win-win situation for them if they get behind this type of quiet leadership, and in doing so, you know, providing some of their product. If they're providing some of their product, the school, now that becomes a win-win for the school, because the school doesn't have to spend the money for, say, the computers or whatever. I think you've got it. If, you know, we're going to need to get funding. Right now, government doesn't have enough money to do anything, so they're not going to fund it. But the schools, it's a win-win in the sense that the corporations will give them something like the computers or whatever they need. The schools then are going to get more really good students coming to their campus. You know, as the campus can expand, they're taking in more money. I think it really is a win-win situation, and I'd love to help in any way I can.
Well, thank you for that. Another piece of the concept, too, is that the high school juniors and seniors who would be invited onto campus can't apply. They have to be selected. They have to be conscripted, because otherwise the people are – what's going to happen if you allow people kids to apply directly is you'll get the ones that are gung-ho that want to be visible leaders, and they'll squeeze out the other ones. So I feel that there has to be a constraint, that whereas the people that who know these students, the high school guidance counselor, principal, the teachers, would have to recommend these kids for acceptance into the program.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense.
That makes sense?
Yeah, or I mean, it can be just, I mean, sort of a point system. I mean, you know, the more the more of the teachers and counselors that are working with them that write them a recommendation letter, you know, the more points essentially they earn, the more community involvement that they do, the more nonprofits that they work with, the more areas where they show leadership in helping those younger than them or less fortunate, they're going to get more points that will put them higher on the scale on who gets chosen to go to that school.
Yes, that's good. I like that.
So, yeah, I think there's a lot of things. And I just glance at the time. We've got a couple of questions that have been – a question and a comment that have been emailed in. Let me get these to you. Mm-hmm. One reads, it says, I heard a story that Franklin's inventions date back to his childhood. I was wondering if the story was true that he made floats that he put on his feet, allowing him to walk across the pond. I'm curious about his parents and elders, and did they inspire this special curiosity and inventive spirit?
Oh, that's a great story. I like it better than the real one, the walking on water. Franklin was a swimmer at an early age, and that's another thing he and I share. I'm a swimmer. But at an early age, when he was a young teen, I think, he invented swim fins. And he used gloves or something. He webbed them, so he made not for his feet, but for his hands. So he invented swim fins. The other thing he invented was kite sailing. He had a lifelong infatuation with a kite, and it started way back when he was a young pint in Boston, swimming in the cove there, and it occurred to him one day that he could get pulled across the water with a kite. So that's what he did.
So, that's great.
And you ask whether he was nurtured in this. Ben Franklin was number 15 in a family of 17. It's not likely he got a lot of independent attention from either one of his parents. Though when the family was that big, often the older children would take on parental roles.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't seem like he had a really strong relationship with anybody in his family except for one younger sister. He was 15. The next child was Jane, and then Lavinia. And Jane was a lifelong correspondent and friend, and those two were close. But I think it's the only closeness that he realized in his family. So he was very independent from the get-go. And he ran away from Boston when he was 17 years old and fully prepared to meet the world because he felt that he could do it at that young age. And he did it.
So it sounds like the inventive spirit, he was hardwired for that.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, well, let me get this another one out. This one is an instant message coming in that says, love your book. It says, we were discussing it last week in my ninth grade history class, and one of poor Richard Lament's famous saying, God help them that help themselves. I was amazed at how heated the debate became when several students referenced that all of our politicians are corrupt and live by this quote, in its negative connotation, and then it says in quotes, helping themselves instead of representing the people they were elected to serve. Obviously, they are listening closely to their parents' conversations. It was sad to know that they feel this way at such an early age. Please give us your comment on this.
Yeah, you know, at what age do we become responsible for our own fate? There's no... It floats around, but at some point you just have to take charge. You have to decide what your values are going to be. What is it you think life is all about? What do you think you want to be your last thought? Do you want your last thought to be that you work the art of the deal and you screwed a whole bunch of people out of their money? Or do you want it that you contributed everything you possibly could to the general good? I mean, those are the extremes. In reality, we'll be somewhere in the middle there, probably. But at some point, we just need to take charge of our own lives and decide what kind of life we want to have and just go from there. I mean, that's what Ben Franklin did in Boston. Just before he ran away, he made certain decisions, and he expressed his values in 13 different virtues that he mentions in the in his autobiography. Mm-hmm. They're material virtues, but they're good ones for engaging the world in a positive way. I mean, the first two being industry and frugality, and then resolution and order. And they're all virtues that you would have to embrace to be successful materially. And they were all virtues that would be kind to other people, that would present you in a positive light, but also shine the light of each one of these virtues on the people that you would be engaged with. Part of what I do in the novels, I try to balance those material values, which are all good, they're all positive. They just like any others, they can serve negative things, ends.
Uh-huh.
Then I try to balance it with, well, what are the natural counterparts to these material values? And I came up with empathy, compassion, generosity, and nine others. And one of the things that the novel recognizes is that life is out of balance in this country. We all sense it, and we've got the materials down. We've got material up. You know, everybody has a certain level of material comfort. But what we haven't focused on is the balance, and that's the empathy, the compassion, all the arrow outward. You know, the arrow pointing outward to our the virtues that contact connect us with other people.
Yeah, and you know, to help get that balance, and unfortunately we've got out of time, but again, I cannot recommend enough for anybody, and especially, you know, if you're getting ready to go on vacation, if you have some time, go out, pick up Poor Richard's Lament, either at bookstores or go to the website. Tom, thank you so much for writing this, and please stay in touch. I would love to know how this other project is, and I'm absolutely serious in the sense that if there's anything that I can do to either help get the word out to people, to help get it to other colleges, just let me know. I love what you're doing, and I think you're on the right track. So thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
All right. And now for everybody out there, please be with us next week on Answers for the Family. And we appreciate all of your calls. We appreciate any of the messages that you get to us, and we will always try to get them on the air. Everybody be safe. Have a great week. Thank you.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox, right here on LA Talk Radio.